Today, we're going to be touching on the Psalms and the good life. And actually, what I'd like to do today is also begin a transition into the Psalms of disorientation, or the seasons of disorientation, and begin to move, because I think that it is such a big field in the Psalms that I'd like to get a head start for tomorrow, so that when we get into some of those Psalms, we already are into it a little bit more. I don't think we allow ourselves enough time. I suggested yesterday that if anyone wants to write a psalm, write a psalm. And I have had several people that have written psalms. And I don't know if that's good or bad. Knowing some of the people that have written them, I'm not too sure if it's good or bad. And to illustrate my concern, I will introduce to you Carol Nolte, come on up here. Well, she's itching to do something, and I don't know what it is.
Nancy Winder and I and Susan Kylo are working on a psalm to present, and Nancy will introduce it.
When Dick suggested we write a psalm, we immediately thought that was an appropriate assignment, and especially given the fact that the psalmists, you know, always write out of their own context. So we felt that would be an important thing to do here at Holden Village. And also, as you know, one of the wonderful things about the Psalms is that they write about things that are very close and dear to all of us. And so along those lines, we have written a lament that we'd like to share with you this morning. And it follows the form of classical lament. It has complaints and cries, the rescue of God, promises and thanksgivings, the calling on the congregation to join in this thanksgiving. And also we have tried, as was the assignment, to follow the lines of Hebrew poetry. You'll find parallel structures, repetitions, synthetic and antithetic parallelism. And many of you will find this entire psalm totally antithetical. Now we've also added another feature of the Psalms in here, and that is the little word Selah, S-E-L-A-H. And as you all know, that's in your Bible. Oh, here we go. Psalms. Nobody knows what it means.
Oh.
So Selah, what Selah is there for is so that people can write PhD theses. That's the whole reason. So one of the possibilities for Selah is that it's a pause, maybe for a musical interlude or for something else to be inserted at that point in the song, we don't know. What we would like to use it for this morning is a congregational response. This is good as that for anything. So Sue here is helping us out, and she has a little sign that says, Selah. And every time she holds that up, you say, Selah. Wonderful. And also this, another part of the repetition in the Psalms, it does have a refrain. Many Psalms have that for liturgical uses, like Psalm 46, you know, the Lord of hosts is with us, the God of Jacob is our refuge, is a refrain in that Psalm. We have a refrain in this Psalm as well, and you're invited to sing along when you catch on. Now, first of all, we have a title page. It's illuminated, we want you to know that. This is Psalm 152. We call it 152 because, you know, they just discovered a real Psalm 151. It's a Holden lament to the choir master after breakfast according to the tailings pile. If you're not sure about all that, look at some of the headings in your psalm. And there's a little bit of Hebrew here to add some class. And we'll tell you what the verse reference for that is later.
Let's move towards silence.
Oh Lord, I am bound up and constrained after the tension of travel. I have eaten of the fruit of the cherry tree and am sore bloated. I weep because of the huckleberry, and moan in my cool chamber because of the watermelon. Oh Lord, you know my down sitting and my uprising, and my down sitting again. The battle rages within me. My inward parts cry out for help. Purge me with hyssop or whatever works, and I shall be clean. How long, O Lord, will my troubles last? How long will your servant suffer agony? O Lord, you know my down sitting and my uprising, and my down sitting again. If you give ear and answer my prayer, early in the morning will I praise you. All the day long will I recall your mercy as I wolf down my food. You are my confidence, O Lord. In your promises I relax. O Lord, you know my down sitting and my uprising, and my down sitting again.
Selah!
I praise you for your goodness, Lord, and all the things you have given. Colon. And canola, 23 grain bread, wheat, germ, and vulgar. You call all your people, O Lord, to a village flowing with yogurt and honey. O Lord, you know my down sitting and my uprising, and my down sitting again. O Lord, you have heard the sounds of my distress and rescued me from the pits. Let the congregation of the faithful, especially those who sit behind me, dance with the full fiber of their being. Then will I praise your name every day with joyful regularity. For you know my down sitting and my uprising, and my down sitting again.
Selah!
Psalm 50, verse 9a. I will accept no bull from thy house.
Okay. Okay, David. Beat that one.
Love it.
Oh. Talking about catching the spirit. Or whatever. I want to thank Nancy, Carol, and Sue for their extraordinary job. There are others, I think, have written psalms. Is there anybody else who wants to follow that one?
You're looking for an anti-climate.
Oh, man. I don't know, that was a psalm of disorientation, orientation, and orientation all in one. We'd like to, today, as I said before, continue with our one of the psalms that we call the psalms that come out of the season of orientation, that is, life, you know, when God is in his heavens and all is right with the world kind of thing. And I'd like us to take a look at Psalm 14. In these psalms, some of the psalms are the wisdom psalms, in which they sound very much like coming from the book of Proverbs, often even portions of maybe the Songs of Solomon. But they are wisdom psalms that are given to instruct. They are not necessarily songs of praise. They're not psalms of the Torah. But they're psalms, just as we have said, psalms, wisdom psalms. And I'd like to have us take a look at Psalm 14. And if someone would read that in its entirety, and we could follow it. I tried to, by the way, in selecting psalms to represent what we are studying, trying to take psalms that are a bit short. Now, some of the psalms are a bit long, but that was one of the reasons for the selection of psalms. But Psalm 14 is 7 verses, and it is a good example of a wisdom psalm. Somebody could read that.
fool says in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They do abominable deeds. There is none that does good. The Lord looks down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there are any that act wisely, that seek after God. They have all gone astray. They are all alike corrupt. There is none that does good. No, not one. Have they no knowledge, all the evildoers, who eat up my people as they eat bread, and do not call upon the name of the Lord? Upon the Lord. There they shall be in great terror, for God is with the generation of the righteous. You would confound the plans of the poor, but the Lord is his refuge. Oh, that deliverance for Israel would come out of Zion. When the Lord restores the fortunes of his people, Jacob shall rejoice, Israel shall be glad.
The fool says in his heart, there is no God. The psalmist here is not, doesn't conceive of a human being as an atheist. This is not a statement of atheism. There is no God. I stand corrected, but I would assert that in the Bible, from the biblical point of view, there is no such thing as atheism. As I say, I stand corrected in that because we have some other biblical scholars certainly in the group here. But I'll say that again. Agnostics, yes. Atheists, no. An atheist is someone who believes that there is no God. That's the definition of atheism. And in biblical thought, that person has a faith or a belief or a God, has a no God. But in biblical thought, that is a religion. And therefore, atheism is such. You don't find a discussion in the Bible either about the existence of God, nor is there a discussion, you know, about atheism itself. I stand corrected that, but I feel that's so true. And so here, when the psalmist is saying, the fool says in his heart, there is no God. He's not saying that atheists are fools. That's not what he's saying. So if you have someone, I've been really disappointed with atheists. I want to say that. Maybe you know an atheist. I really, in my experience of ministry, even now, I don't know of an atheist. When somebody tells me they're an atheist, as I say, I've been always disappointed. I remember down in San Diego in my parish, I met a family and where the husband and wife were avowed atheists. And they told me such. We're avowed atheists. We believe there is no God. And I said, gee, this is a real neat experience for me. I mean, here's an atheist. You know? And, you know, you can sit down and really have some interesting dialogue. But I said to the atheist, I said, one question bothers me about you. Why do you send your kids to my Sunday school? That's true. I performed the marriage for one of their daughters, too. A great disappointment to me. I says, how can you even flirt with religion? You know, et cetera, et cetera. But the psalmist is not talking about atheism here. The psalmist is talking about what we might call practical atheism. Practical atheism means that people live out life as though God does not exist. They just go through life as though God is not a reality. They go through life saying that they can manage life in the world better than Yahweh. And therefore, Yahweh is of no particular consequence. And they live out life. They live out life because they want to live it outside of what we might say, outside of God. And the psalmist is saying that particular, and suddenly this becomes rather contemporary. We say, hey, you know, to some degree, this may touch on us a little bit. You know, the fool says that there is no God. That means that you can live life outside of God, that you can live out and be, you know, a practical atheist. For all practical purposes, that's what you are. that person's a fool, a very foolish person. And it goes on to say that because this person is hard, he acts as if God is not. And where God is not, we find in verse 1 that actions become corrupt. They become corrupt. They no longer can reflect the good. These people also, according to the psalmist, practical atheists, that is, those who live as though God does not exist. In verse 4, they are without discernment. They have no knowledge. Knowledge doesn't mean they're not smart or they don't know a lot of things. It means here that they have no discernment, and they give evidence of that because they exploit other people. If you put God out of the picture, then you can deal with human beings, you see, as if God doesn't exist. And those kind of individuals, according to the psalmist, exploit people. They eat up my people as they eat bread. The person who lives as if God doesn't exist, their end result is a life that is filled with terror. Now, there's a counter theme that's going on in this particular psalm. And the counter theme is this: there is still God in this world, and it is his world. This is the great assertion. This is his world. And God governs. Verse 2, we read, "The Lord looks down from heavens upon the children of men to see if there are any that act wisely, that seek after God." He wants to find people who seek after the same good that he seeks. God loves people who loves what he loves. You know. So he looks down here and from the heavens to see if there are any that act wisely, to seek after God. I have a lot of notes, and I don't even know where my notes all come from. I scribble things down, for better or for worse, in my Bible, and I put down the wise worship God because the wise person knows that they need their need for forgiveness. But this is what the Lord finds in verse 3, that the practical atheist has gone astray, and they are corrupt. There is none that does good, no, not one. So God is in his world. He's really at the center of things. He still governs in a very disorientated world. His business, as my note comes in verse 6, "You would confound the plans of the poor, but the Lord is his refuge." The psalmist is asserting that in this world where there are people who live as though God doesn't exist, which means they don't live in the reality, not only of God, but also the reality of the good. Yet Yahweh still governs in this kind of disorientated world. And God's business, even in a world which is distracted by fools, by these kind of people, his business is to guard and keep the poor. Again, another psalm in which the business of God, as well as the business of the believing community, one of their prime businesses is to take care of the poor. Poor are those people that have no one to come to their side, no advocates to attend to their business. And so the poor are not left to the capricious activities of the foolish. And much of, as we see, of God's rule is the certitude of Yahweh's concern and Yahweh's solidarity with the poor. We find it in this particular psalm likewise.
Can I say something about that? I do know lots of atheists, and I don't know whether they're practical or impractical, but it seems to me that in the teaching world, I've met many, many people who not only live as though they are outside of God's world, but in fact renounce any belief in God, any kind of spiritual world. And it seems to me that one of the things that makes me nervous about the, and some of these are my friends, some of them are my relatives. It makes me nervous when I hear people in the church use this psalm as a kind of proof that we're right and they're wrong, and it cuts off all communication. It'd be, it seems to me that this cry of the psalmist that says, the fool in his heart says there is no God, that a way to use that for myself is when I have been acting in a way that is outside of God's world, as though God didn't exist, that this becomes a way of confession, that I have been a fool because I have behaved been in this kind of thought. But I think the cutting off of communication between believers and unbelievers by using this kind of quotation to say that I'm right and all you other people are.
That's not what the psalm is saying.
I know, but it seems to me that, you know, that's, it really bothers me when I hear it, instead of a discussion about how to bridge the gap between the atheists and the believers, or the agnostics, if you want to say that's what they really are, that we struggle so hard to get people to admit there's a God, instead of trying to figure out where they are, and not force them to deal with our categories or.
I'm hearing you. I'm hearing you. I think that we heard this. If I am right about the Psalms, and here again, let us share with our knowledge of the Psalms. The psalmist is writing both to and within what we might call the covenant community here, Carol.
Yeah.
And I don't believe the Psalms is speaking here about the Edomite or the Babylonian at this particular point. You know what I'm saying? Outside of it. And the way I read this Psalm, those who within the believing, quote, the covenant community, who live as though God does not exist, would make it a very real confessional kind of statement. Are we reading, Carol?
I think you said it, that there is no God is the dialectic of the proof that there is.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the you say there's no God. That's all. There's, you're admitting the existence of God.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That's, heard that argument presented on part of atheism.
Again, remember, as believers, we stake our life on the existence of God. And you go back to Hebrews 11, where we stake our life on that. And what should be happening then is that our lifestyle should reflect that kind of use the word faith commitment.
The other word is wisely. And there, that I think it was recently either read or heard of pastors say that wisdom only comes from God. In other words, wisdom comes from God. We create facts and knowledge, you know, in the frames of the dominion that we have, but we see wise people in the entire, you know, wise people maybe representing all kinds of divisions of maybe atheism, agnosticism, what have you, but the wisdom that exists comes from God. That's a statement somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So when he speaks, we act wisely, we seek after God. But wisdom comes from him alone.
The footnote in the New International Version says the Hebrew words rendered fool in Psalms denote one who is morally deficient.
Pardon me? My
translation says that the word fool used in this denote one who is morally deficient.
Morally deficient. Okay. Again, just to maybe restate what Carol's concern too. In verse 4, have they no knowledge, all the evildoers who eat up my people as they eat bread, and do not call upon the Lord? I feel here what is being lamented here, or what is being stated, is not only just, quote, the universal corruption of humanity, you know, that they fail to call upon God, but very precisely in this psalm, it prevails no less in Israel as in the heathen world. And therefore, we could say it prevails no less in the church, you know, if we want to make this at home. And so perhaps the psalm, as we use this psalm, We have to say, am I the one who lives out life as if though God is not for real, you know, every day of my life, as if though God does not exist? Any more comments on this psalm?
I think Carol brought up a good point, though, that dealing with friends who express no God in a sense, and that is hard to deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
And relating to them, I've offended some friends once in a while, not meaning to be, in that light of not trying to argue, but to present God's side of the case.
Mm-hmm.
I think the key point is to try as hard as we can not to appear judgmental in our dealings with these people, because of course it will be God who will judge these people. But I think we have to be firm in our faith as well.
Any more comments on the psalm? Yeah, Bill.
It's been my experience that there are just as many people who say there is a God that are fools as those who say there is no God. And it's also been my experience with friends that I've known that there are just as many people who say there is no God who are wise as those who say there is a God who are wise. Because it seems to me that you're always reacting against a certain kind of God. Luther, in effect, said there is no God, replying to a type of God that was being peddled in his day.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Aren't we, it seems to me there's a little bit too much of Western thought in Greek and Platonic. We're approaching the Hebrew here with really the philosophical bent.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that, you know, it's really talking about really rotten evil deeds and corrupting the poor and victimizing people and really rotten destruction of other humans. I think the psalm is rather graphic in saying these are evil deeds. It's not a matter of philosophical arguments about atheism or agnosticism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can you grab that? Anybody else?
Is the writer complaining here that they don't believe in our God of Israel?
No.
Talking to the enemies of Israel?
No. I would assert that the psalmist here, this being a wisdom psalm, is being used within the community of the covenant community. Because within the covenant community, you will find, just because you're part of, quote, Israel, doesn't mean you're automatically live out life as though God is for real, you know? Like you're born into the church, doesn't mean you really believe that Jesus Christ can be taken seriously. And I feel that's where the psalm comes in. And there's people who live as though God and all that God is, and all of the Torah, we would say, stands for, really is unessential. I live out life my own way. And it comes about as a life that is filled with all kinds of, as you pointed out, if you don't take God seriously, from the psalmist's point of view, you won't take people, you know, seriously. And it comes out with all these kinds of very unjust systems in where the poor are trampled upon, etc., etc. And from the psalmist's point of view, the trampling of the poor or dealing in a dishonorable way with your fellow human being is evidence that you are not in a right relationship with Yahweh. Because for the psalmist, if you're in a relationship with Yahweh, it's going to be seen in your right relationship with people. So if that's why I say, and therefore this is a practical atheism, when you say, hey, you live out life as though, you know, God doesn't exist, which means I can treat people the way I want to treat them rather than to treat them the way they should be treated.
I think we judge people on their atheism or agnosticism on their philosophical words.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems here it's coming through that, because we got relatives too who are atheists or agnostics, who are very kind and gentle, who are honorable, you know, maybe they're shooting down some theological conceptions of God, mm-hmm. and maybe their reality of God is more subtle, mm-hmm. and their deeds are good, and they're helping, mm-hmm. you know, and their lives are really mm-hmm. quite nice. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, two of the males in our family are, I enjoy being with them. That's a terrible thing to say. But I enjoy being with them more than I enjoy being with some of my own parishioners. Mm-hmm. No, we have no parishioners here. So. We have every congregation.
Anybody else comments on this psalm? This psalm book with a little bit of good discussion. If you could see this as a wisdom psalm, a psalm that was didactic in its nature, that is used in the community as not just to educate the young, but educate each one of us that we don't become the fool. And we live out our life as though God does not exist. Oh, that deliverance for Israel, for the church, would come out of Zion. Zion is always the source of salvation. Zion always becomes the source of salvation. When the Lord restores the fortunes of his people, and Jacob shall rejoice and Israel shall be glad. There's a statement here, sort of an eschatological hope, you know, that comes into the Psalms often. And it's not quite a doxology, but certainly it says when God is God, it does give this eschatological hope.
Is Zion on the Temple Mount at this time?
I would say yes. Zion is a symbol for both the temple and the presence. Mm-hmm. Let us shift gears a little bit with our time that's left. And I'd like to... there's several other psalms that maybe you want to read on your own. I put down Psalm 133 and 131. They're short little psalms. Just take a quick look at them. I just want to call your attention to them because they're so small and yet they're so beautiful, and they certainly state something about the Psalms of well-being, and to discover again what it means to be Psalms of well-being. Let's take a look at Psalm 133 first. Somebody just read that quickly. And it's so short. It's only three verses. Just, you know, without trying to exposit the psalm and maybe all of its fullness, just using an example, it's an eloquent affirmation of the family or of the tribe. We might say of our family experience up here at Holden. And actually, in this particular psalm, Yahweh doesn't do anything. I don't even know, you know, it doesn't do anything. It just... that just acknowledged to be, God is just acknowledged to be the hidden source of well-being. You know, just everyday life. And the common joys of life are always attributed to the generosity of Yahweh. Very simple psalm. Just life. And it says that when we dwell in unity, you know, when there is this thing of harmony within a family, it's like the precious oil on the head. It's a sign of extravagance, you know. It's a measure of extravagance. And it's one of God's signs of God's grace. Bonhoeffer, in his Life Together, if you read that book, he says in several places that when you discover in your fellowship with each other, this moment today, right now, you are seeing a sign of God's grace, the abundant and extravagant grace of God. You see? Because next moment that siren might ring. Yeah, I mean, the moment, this moment is a sign of God's grace. And maybe this is what the psalmist is saying here. I just call your attention to it, that the psalmist celebrates not the extravagances of life. I told you, not the sweepstake winnings, you know? Just, hey, today we've had a beautiful day with the family. Signs of God's grace and graciousness. I can say that. Look at Psalm 131. Again, three verses. Can someone just read that one? I'm just touching on that without getting into it. Unless somebody else wants to make comments, please do. Psalm 131, just read that one. everything in life is, again, reliable for this particular, for the psalmist, for the songwriter. And yet he realizes that life isn't just simple. He says that to understand all of life and understand all of this as relates to God is something beyond him. That God's thoughts are truly beyond his thoughts, and God's ways are truly beyond his ways. And yet he feels some of that in the experience of his well-being. And again, God's motherly care comes out. Don't miss that. There's a characterization here of a relationship with God that has grown, you know, out of the observing of a very simple part of life. In our chalet right now, we have a family that's moved in with a little baby. What, 4 weeks old? Is Tim here? He was here before.
I think he
just left. And Tim had a little one there, yeah. 1 month old. 4 weeks and 1 month, it's close. And so on. But it's in the mother's arms. And here's a picture, you know, you see that child, total trust, total. And the psalmist here uses that this kind of dependency upon the mother, an absolute dependency. He says that's what he discovers in God, this motherly care. And can celebrate that. Just celebrate that. So it's no big thing, you know, in one sense. And yet, maybe it's everything. Anyway, two short psalms, 133 and 131. Psalms that are certainly comes out of the seasons of orientation. God is in his heavens, and all is right with the world. Just everyday life.
Nick?
Yeah.
What?
I don't know about you, but coming back home from the office or the work for the day, you come back into your house, and usually your house has some sense of order. I'm not trying to say everything is in its place. But, of course, if you have a lot of teenagers around, maybe it isn't. But no, even there, it feels good to be home. Because even that becomes part of your order of life. And there is some sense of that, of quietude and so forth. Sure, a child comes in the house right away, and of course, the first thing he says is what? Mother?
Mother?
Mother? And all she has to say, yeah, and then takes off again. But he has to have, no. It's that point again. The point again that all is right with the world. If the mother doesn't answer the kid, right away he's frantic until he hears that voice. And so the motherly care of God, this kind of thing, you know, that we want to have that touch of base, you know. Yeah. All I'm going to say is that I'd like to get over it, is that there are many psalms that just speak of the ordinary things of life. They can celebrate that. Maybe that's teach us sophisticated.
Remember too that the house is not always the home, but the home can be wherever the people that you want to be with are.
Yeah, like right up here.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is home for us right up here. Can we begin to shift gears and today as we prepare for tomorrow, and we have 5 minutes left, and I'd like to just begin to get us thinking about Psalms of disorientation. In Marty's new book called The Cry of Absence, which maybe some of you have read, he makes this particular comment here. I'll be referring to this book from time to time. Marty struggling with the absence of God. And he calls the wintry landscape of the soul. And he uses the pictures of nature, like winter and snow, you know, when everything is cold and frozen over. And you really can pick up a lot of feeling out of his book. And his book is an interesting commentary and approach on the Psalms, which he uses all the way through his book. Anyway, he makes this comment. He says, to my surprise, and I read this because I think it's always to our surprise, and I was surprised that Marty said, this is to my surprise, because I thought Marty knew everything. he's an old buddy of mine, his old classmate, etc. And just a remarkable human being in many respects. And this is why I'm reading from him. He's, to my surprise, more than one half of the Psalms have had their major burden or context life on the wintry landscape of the heart. More than half. Many more contain extensive reference to spiritual terrains of winter, even when it did not predominate in the psalm itself. Only one-third of the Psalms were the simple property of those for whom summary style would exhaust Christian spirituality. What he means by that is that so many times a Christianity is interpreted in just praise the Lord and the happy life. And maybe that's been your experience too in the church, that there are those for whom, at least it seems, that when you become a Christian, everything becomes summer. And there is a summary style that really exhausts all kinds of Christian spirituality. So that if you are not feeling the joy of the Lord 24 hours a day, there is something wrong with your spirituality. Because if you really were spiritual and you were into the Lord, you would be, quote, in this on top of the world kind of experience. There's a colleague of mine in Southern California. He used to teach at a evangelical college up near Santa Barbara. And he said one of the things, he was the only Lutheran in the faculty, and one of the things Rod said was that up there, at least, if you are really into your Christian faith, you live a life of smiles. And everybody's around in the day, they're always the joy of the Lord. And by the way, that can be legitimate. Marty makes that thing too. That's not a put down. But he said, you know, up there, he said, I began to, if you know Ron a little bit, as a good Lutheran, I believe in the confession of sins and absolution. Confession of sins means that there's something disorientated in your life. At any rate, the students found out about Ron. And he found out somebody would come to him and just dump. No joys. I mean, just dump. And he said, you know, it was beautiful because he had an opportunity for confession and absolution. Because there were a lot of the kids up there, which doesn't maybe surprise any of us, that really were living in the winter landscapes of life. But they somehow felt it wasn't Christian to witness that or to share that. That made them a lesser kind of a Christian. What Marty is proposing, and I'm not saying it because it's Marty, but I think that he's picked up something in the Psalms, that you can be in the wintry, and some of us are the trains, spiritual trains of winter of our spirituality. And that means that we are out there closer to where, quote, the agnostics are, if you want to be out there, than we are sometimes, you know, where the warm vibrance of that beautiful, you know, where everything is in joy is concerned. But out there, you may also have a very real spiritual experience in the sense that God may become more real out there than he comes in here. Luther said that. Martin Luther said, Luther always says things in categorical statements. He says, God only meets us in the depths. Now, don't challenge him on the only, please. But what he is saying there, hey, it's in the depths. You know, out there in the wintry landscape, which is suddenly, there's nothing you can hang on to out there. And so you meet God on a very naked, bare kind of an encounter, which may mean a more real encounter than when you're clothed with all things going good. Good health, you're prosperous, you're successful, you know, the larder is full, praise the Lord. You know, and I'm not, and by the way, and that's no, we just said in these Psalms of orientation, that's not a put down. That is something that it's a very legitimate thing, and it's something that we all not only crave, it's something that's a beautiful part of faith. All we're saying now is, to my surprise, there are more than half of the Psalms have their major burden in the context of life in the wintry landscape of the heart. Which says that we walk into the Psalms of disorientation. Because life, you see, is, you know, not just filled with equilibrium, you know, and all kinds of symmetry. There's a lot of dissymmetries in our life, and we say yes to that. These psalms of darkness, we might say, may be judged as acts of unfaith by people outside the covenant community. But we're going to, I hope, see that these particular psalms are going to be bold acts of faith. Bold acts of faith. And they're going to confront God in ways that are almost embarrassing, because they will express the world as it really is. You know, with its uprisings and its downsides. And we'll experience all disorders also have a proper relationship to God and have a proper discourse with God. And there's nothing that's out of bounds. There's nothing that's out of bounds. And therefore, everything must be brought to speech. The psalmist is bringing it to speech. And therefore, it must be brought to speech, and it must be addressed to God. Because God is the final reference for all of life, including the wintry landscape of the heart. Now, that's taking God seriously. And in the Psalms that we will encounter, we'll begin to see how the psalmist is taking all of this not only seriously, but also I think we'll see some fresh characteristics of God. At least I hope so. In the Psalms of disorientation, I'm going to begin with Psalm 13, because Psalm 13 is, again, short, six verses, and it's a very concise psalm. It's a very concise lament. And it gives us maybe some handles on how the lament psalms are structured. There is a structure for the lament psalms. Klaus Westermann in his books makes much of that. But I'm not too interested in just in structure. It's just that when you can look at the lament psalm. And then, if not tomorrow, I'm going to try to get into Psalm, which is probably one of the darkest psalms in the entire book of Psalms, is Psalm 88. Because in this psalm there is no hope. Which is an interesting way to have a psalm. But we are going to then begin to talk a little bit tomorrow about this, the seasons of disorientation, which evokes all kinds of feelings of doubt, anger, bitterness, blame, gripes, and lays it all out on God, which is interesting. So, thanks for your participation today. Have a good day at Holden.